The house I was here, my parents were the farthest thing from that. I lived 35 miles away from campus. My mom and dad drove me down that day and literally were like, kid, get out of the car. They didn't come upstairs to the top floor or anything like that. They were, they weren't that type. There's no way they were going to meetings or anything like that. So I got all my stuff. I didn't even have any luggage. I got all my stuff and took it upstairs, and it took me like 2 minutes to put my stuff in my room and walked out in the lounge and met Tim Audram. And I'm not sure how this happens, but early on we decided to skip meetings together and actually nominated each other for freshman class president. He got one vote and I got one vote, so I figured that out. I think we voted for each other, not the other person. So. I think we voted for ourselves. So, but anyway, we've been friends for a long time, and it seems like it's that God's put us together to allow us to do ministry together from afar. And so I know that, like Mark and Dave talked about the session. If there's one thing, you know, that I've appreciated about Tim is his faithfulness over the long haul. I've known him for a long time, and he's the same. He's always been. And I think that's integrity. I think that's, I mean, he has a heart for kids. I mean, he is, as he will tell you, he's an old man, and he goes to wrestling practice every day at the high school and volunteered. And even that alone, I mean, he's very influential in that high school, Lafayette Jefferson High School. But it started by him volunteering, and the coach, who tended to be a jerk in those days, said, okay, are you willing to clean off the wrestling mats like every day and pick up the towels, and kind of put them on a spot, like, would you be willing to do those things when that was the level of your glory? Is I mean, you know how wrestlers are. His job was to clean off the mats and clean the towels, and yet he did that, and now he has the keys for one of the biggest high schools in the state of Indiana and the country, and God has used him in a mighty way. Faithfulness over the long haul. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways that's talking about Tim. And so I know we're going to give him as much time here. We're not going to do, we're not going to do music or worship. We're not going to do either one, unless you want me to sing. But I'm not sure anybody does. But Tim, thanks, man. Thanks for your leadership, and thanks for your ministry.
Thanks. Yeah, I've coached wrestling for 35 years, and 20. I'm in my 20th season in Lafayette Jeff High School. And so I went from cleaning mats to washing towels, and if you go over there, like, my name's on the wall at different places now, too. So that, you know, that, again, that's just a function of being old. I don't think that means I'm all that good at that. That's too much, really. John chapter 4, if you got your Bible and open up there. I do love kids. I love working with kids. I love people who work with kids. I taught youth ministry for 17 years at a Crossroads Bible College in Indianapolis, and that's a Bible college that trains students to work in a multi-ethnic and an urban world. And if you know much about African American churches, youth ministry is not a real high priority there. You have grandma to do youth ministry, you have YMCA and Boys and Girls Clubs, and high schools and junior high schools to do youth ministry. So I spent most of those years teaching classes and having great students, and many of those men and women are working with kids now out in local churches and cities and in other areas. But at the same time, I tried to motivate all that time. I was always trying to motivate people to think there's a high value of youth ministry, and because I think there is, I think there was, and I think there will be. And I really feel. And like Dave and Mark said, like Dave said, I just don't understand why not everybody just is not chomping at the bit to get out there and work with kids. You know, I really think that. And so that's kind of the approach I'm going to take.
We're not going to go to Panera Bread.
I'm sorry?
I left my email program open.
Oh,
so
that's that ding dong was?
Panera Bread just showed up.
So I really want to motivate us. And I feel that at this time in my life, I feel that, we talked about, I'm a baby boomer. Mel's a baby boomer. In 1972, in the fall, two baby boomers met in Ridley Hall at then Baptist Bible College in Pennsylvania. And we began to work with some younger kids. We were sort of at the end of the baby boom, or a few years later, and Those students we began to work with were these guys, some of you guys. They became what? Who? Generation X? I don't know if they ever had another name than that. Did they? Busters. Okay. Yeah, Busters. And then after them became the Millennials. And we've been becoming experts for the last few years about working with kids that are in the Millennial generation. And now all of a sudden, those guys are young adults and adults. The Millennials. And so what's next? What's the next generation? It was July 17th, 2008. New Hope for Philadelphia. Mel Walker and I were eating breakfast in the Crown Plaza on City Line Boulevard in Philadelphia. And I had read the front page article of one of those sections in the USA Today that they give away in the hotels. And the article said this. It said, in the year 2007... as many babies were born in the United States, more babies than at any other time since the middle of the baby boom in 1957. They were comparing kids born in 2007, the volume of kids, to the volume of kids that were born in the United States in 1957. And I read that article to Mel that morning at breakfast, and I said, man, what are we going to do with Vision for Youth? This is the next thing coming down the pipe. We're reading an article in 2008 of something that happened in 2007. And now those kids are here. Really, the kids in our youth groups are part of this generation, but that big group of kids born in 2008 are in school right now. And we don't even know what to call them yet. So I got a little small print up there, Generation Z, or the Homeland Generation. And so what do those guys look like? How do you work this? That's how. Advertising. I went to many colleges to learn how to run this thing. This clicker. People that work, social scientists, educators, and advertisers. Really, we get a lot of our information about generations through people who want to sell them stuff. Because of the sheer volume, 60 million kids from the ages of 4 years old up through the age of 18, 19 years old. That's what's going on now. And these guys, we really don't know what we're doing yet with this generation because they're all young still. Most of them are still young. But 60 million kids, and you guys were talking earlier about, you know, the church is everybody, you know, but 51% or more of our country is this group of people and young adults, teenagers and kids is the majority, make up the majority of our country. They're born in during the 1990s up through about the mid-200s, 2000s. I mean, like, we're in 2015 right now, so, you know, back that off a couple of years. And I already told you about 2007, and there are charts you can look all that stuff up, but never in our history of our country, in terms of kids being born, has anybody been compared to the baby boom generation until this generation right now. So that's a big deal because we in the baby boom were big deals. And people are expecting this group to be a big deal. I like Homeland Generation because I can say it. How is it different than Millennials? And just real quickly, and I'm not going to even talk about this. I'm just showing it to you. We do seminars with training youth workers. Bring us to your church in your area and we'll work on this in more depth. But we're different. This generation of Homeland kids or Generation Z is different than Millennials, and they're more tech-savvy. We talked about that. They're more private, as proven by the type of apps they use on their phones and computers. They're a different demographic. They're different demographic, and they think differently about demographics. This is the first generation to actually admit about their race. They self-identify as being mixed race. In the last couple of years, people who self-identify, we're talking about people, junior highers, elementary school kids, it's gone up 134%, those who will admit to being half white and half black. And in the same amount of time, it's gone up 87%, those that admit to being half Asian and half white. These are people that would have said in the past, I'm white or I'm Asian, kind of whispered it. Now they're starting to step up and say, hey, this is who we are. First generation, for the last 8 years, they've had a half white, half black president of the United States of America. So that's what they know. In their culture, there has been an attitude shift about social issues. And a lot of times, those of us in the church, we really jump on social issues because our Supreme Court of our country said that gave constitutional rights to same-sex marriage, as an example. And kids are more socially active culture in their culture about race. They're more conscious about these things. They're more accepting of it because that is what they are growing up with. Multicultural. More and more changes on a daily basis. I used to tell my classes in college, and I'm talking to people who are training to work in an urban area, that if they get outside their front door in any city in Indiana or Illinois or Ohio or Michigan or Pennsylvania, wherever we're from here, you're going to see multicultural stuff. You're going to see more Latino people, more Hispanics, more Asians, more whatever the latest thing is. And you don't have to go into an urban or inner city anymore. I think of a little town in Indiana that's like 30 miles, it's not even 30 miles. It takes 15 minutes from my house to the turnoff. I turn left and go another 10 minutes. I'm at a small town where the Mexican mafia is really prevalent. That town is known for Fritos. Actually, they sell Fritos. They have a big Frito plant. And you wrestle their high school, and there's nobody with a European or an American name on their high school wrestling team. The town doesn't even have 15,000 people in some cornfield town in Indiana. So these kids are growing up in a multicultural United States of America, one that certainly people my age is a little bit foreign to, but even some of you younger guys. I mean, you know, when I moved to Lafayette, Indiana 21 years ago, the town was 98% Caucasian. And now we don't even talk about that anymore. It's 98% Caucasian and 3% free and assisted lunch programs. And now it's 90% free and assisted lunch programs in 21 years. And that's just the changes that these kids are growing up with. Multicultural. Their parents, Generation X, or some of the older kids' parents, and these Generation X people were grown up, have grown up as latchkey kids. They listen to Nirvana and groups like them, and they watch slasher movies. Stephen King's been mentioned, and who's that other guy? Wes Craven has been mentioned. That's who these guys grew up watching, so that when they had kids, they became helicopter parents, and they began to protect their parents. And now the Generation X, and now some helicoptered kids. The millennial kids are becoming the parents as well. I'm a grandfather of a 3-year-old, and my millennial son is, you know, so you've got two generations now from the helicopter parents who really protected their kids, and to the kids who are protected are now parents, and now they're really protecting their kids. That's one reason they call it the Homeland Generation, because the Homeland Bureau of Homeland Safety protects us in the United States. They have a future, a view of the future that's colored by growing up in hardship, war, economic trouble. Optimism is replaced by pragmatism. It's a first generation. When you ask them, are you going to be better off than your parents, they're saying no. The American dream for them in their mind is different than what their parents and grandparents had. But they're becoming pragmatic about it. They're going to say, hey, but we're going to take it as it comes, and we're going to do what it takes to do what we want. There's a song advertising some cruise lines, and it's a regular song. I don't know who says it or anything else, but every time it comes on, it catches my attention. It says, I'm going to do whatever I want with whoever I want, wherever I want, because I'm free. That's sort of that pragmatic attitude showing up in a tomb. And then there's control. They like to be in control, so they will do what it takes, even to the point these kids are dressing better than I do, because they want to look nice for when opportunities are going to be there. They want to make an impression. They, you know, and I see that because I, compared to them, I'm a bum. My barber last week changed my hairstyle, unbeknownst to me. I just showed up, like, you know. And the kids in the locker room and in the hallways were like, hey, coach, like your hair. I didn't even know he changed my hair. So I went and looked in the mirror, and yep, it was like up like that, a little bit over like that. But they noticed that kind of stuff. Now, if I had changed my hair and tucked my shirt in, woo, I'd have been a stud in school that day. No kidding. So, but they pay attention to that kind of thing. And I have to read about it, or it happened to me, or I would never notice. So that's what these kids are like. And like I said, bring us some time into
where you are, and we'll spend a lot of time on this stuff, but not today.
How are we going to reach these kids? Here's another example. We're in Brooklyn, New York. And again, I've worked with teenagers for 41 years. I've taught safety seminars. I've taught, you know, how we're supposed to do that. How are you going to work with kids and still be doing it after 41 years? I mean, I can kind of give you some hints about that. Brooklyn, New York, where you stayed in a hotel for New Hope for New York City. And we were right down the street, maybe a couple miles from the Recovery House of Worship, which is a church founded by and for people that are addicted to things. So that's who we worked with there. And right across the street from our hotel was a little strip mall. It probably wasn't any longer than the front of this room. And on this end was a Hot and Now. And these guys were open until 11:30 at night. So we got done with everything. And at 11:30, we'd go over and have some French fries or a milkshake or something. Vision for Youth likes to treat the youth workers who bring the students. So we'd go over there one night and buy for everybody and just have some fellowship. And then right down the storefronts, right down like right here where this sign is, was a drive-up window for a Dunkin' Donuts. And it was literally wasn't that far from that door. After 11 o'clock, the Dunkin' Donuts closed. But the drive-up window was open till 2 in the morning. We found out one night you couldn't walk up to the window and order anything. You had to actually drive up to the window, or the guy wouldn't get you anything. One night, it's about 11:30, and we were done for the day, and Alan Moody, who works with us, he was here this week. We went across the street from our hotel. We went to Hot and Now. There's about 20 kids in there sitting there eating ice cream and stuff. And a girl named Alex walks up to me. Right up, she met me outside on the sidewalk. Alex is a girl and a beautiful young lady, and she said, "Hey, can you go through the drive-thru?" Now, literally, we parked. We pulled in right here. We're facing this way, parked this way. We're parked about 30 feet from the drive-thru. "Will you go through the drive-thru and give me some coffee? That guy won't let me walk up and get coffee." I said, "No, I'm not going to go through the drive-thru. I just pulled in and parked." And I said, "Can you drive?" And she said, "Well, yeah." And I gave her the keys to my car. In 41 years of youth ministry, I've never given a teenager the keys to my car, ever. And it was 11 o'clock at night. All she had to do was back it out, drive it about 15 feet to the window, make her order and get it, and then park it again. I said, "Can you park a car?" She goes, "Well, yeah." I said, "Okay." So I turned around. Al and I went into the Hot and Now where all of her friends were sitting. And all of a sudden, right as soon as I opened the door, they all go, "What did you do?" I said, "What are you talking about? What did you do with your keys to your car?" I said, "I gave them to Alex." "Why did you do that?" I said, "Well, she wants coffee and a donut, a Dunkin' Donut." Then one kid goes, "She's only 14 years old." And immediately, my whole life went before my eyes. Immediately. Alex is only 14 years old. She looked like she was 27 if she was a day. And I still didn't think too much of it. She's only going to back it out, drive it like 15 feet, order coffee, and park it again. Until all 20 of those kids get up and run out into the parking lot so they can watch her drive a car. And then I knew I really was in trouble. So I'm following all these kids out in the parking lot. She's got it backed out. She's trying to inch it up toward the drive-up window. She's actually there. And I hit the trunk with my hand like, "Stop driving the car, you're only 14. So she looks, she goes, "What's the matter? I said that." She goes, "No, I turned 15 last week." I said, "Okay, I feel better." So about this time I woke up, I said, "Alex, you told me you could drive." She said, "I can." I said, "Okay." I said, she goes, "Am I in trouble?" I said, "No, I think I am. If anybody tells on me." She goes, "Well, that's okay, because this guy doesn't understand what he wants." You know, New York City is a big city. Sometimes it's not always Midwestern people working at the drive-up windows at 11:30 at night. And she says, "I want some 2 iced coffees and a donut." "What would you like in your hot coffee?" "2 iced coffees and a donut." "What kind of hot coffee?" "2. She goes, "Will you drive through and order for me? Because he won't listen to me." I said, "I'm not going to." She starts getting out of the car. I said, "You're not getting out of the car." I said, "You get over there by the passenger side." I said, "I'll order for you, but I'm not buying your stuff for you. You stay in this car." So I said, "Hey, buddy, iced coffee." So We got iced coffee. And I backed up 15 feet, parked it, pulled it in and parked it. We got out of the car, and I'm like, all these kids are still in the parking lot. They're like cheering and all kinds of stuff. Alex drove the guy's car. He's only 14. Chelsea starts the argument. I'm 15 last week. My life is still going from, I know that I'm going to be fired, not only fired, totally arrested. I know that I'll never be hired by anybody who, you know, would trust someone with a teenager again. Because I let her back the car out and drive 15 feet. Finally, we get out, and I said, Alex, I thought you told me you could drive. She said, I didn't tell you I could drive. I said, well, when I asked you if you could drive, I kind of meant, do you have a driver's license? And she said, but you didn't ask me that. And I said, oh, my bad. So by now it's midnight. I went in and had a stiff drink of milkshake. But you didn't ask me that. She was right. John chapter 4, I think, is a great passage of Scripture, and we all know the story. But to me, it's a great passage of Scripture that takes me to the place of, how can I work with this generation of people who says, but you didn't ask me that? Because we've all made the observations. The lady asked Jesus, and Jesus asked the lady a ton of questions, and then the disciples asked Jesus a question, and not one question in the entire story is answered in the way that it was asked. So let's look at that story. I really think that we can minister to these kids, not if we become normal, not if we stay like we are, and not if our churches stay like we are. We kind of alluded to that unplanned way through some of our seminars. You know, Ross was saying we're going to evangelize kids as we change up what we do, and we do some things differently. And I think that's what Jesus is calling us to do. My Bible was just here, and it went away as soon as I picked it up. That's a function. If I had some of these Generation Z kids here, we'd have that Bible back in no time. Does anybody know how to work this? Give my Bible back. Is that okay? For the main page. So Jesus is walking through Samaria, and the passage says he had to go through. Whether or not he had, thank you, whether or not he had to go through there, how'd you do that?
Okay, we'll see the button.
The bottom of the button?
Yep. And if you tap that twice really fast, it will shoot up all the apps that you opened up recently.
Hey, I knew that, man. I'll just leave it to you. Hey, have your pastor call me. I'll give you good recommendations for you. Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, Jesus was a Jew, and we all know Jews and Samaritans hated one another. So Jesus knew that people were talking about him. He left. Verse 4, he had to go through Samaria on the way. Eventually, he came to the Samaritan village of Sychar near the field of Jacob, which Jacob gave to his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was there. Now listen, here's what I'm going to say to you. I think we can minister, and I think we're going to need to minister to this generation. First of all, we've got to see that it's coming, because it is coming. In 2007, they were born. They were born before that, but the big bunch of them were born then. I think that we have to, and this is sort of a weird thing to say. My pastor said it once, and I wrote it down, and I've loved it ever since. We have to live lives that are questionable. We have to live questionable lives. You didn't ask me that question. We have to live lives that are questionable. And what's a questionable life look like? I think it looks like Jesus in John 4. Soon a Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus, after his long walk, had sat wearily beside the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Please give me a drink." He was alone at the time because his disciples had gone into the village to buy some food. The woman was surprised. That's the first characteristic, I think, of a person who lives a questionable life. We are people who are surprising. We're people who are surprising. Mark Myers is talking, and I'm laughing at a lot of things he said. He's a surprising guy. Y'all didn't get the joke, is the only reason you didn't laugh. You know, but he's a surprising guy, and the ones you understood, you laughed at. The woman was surprised. Here is a Jew sitting next to the well. A Jew sitting next to the well at noon. She came out at noon. Ladies came out in the evening to get water. She wanted to avoid everybody. She didn't want to talk to anybody. So she came out at a time when nobody was there. We'll find out later why that was. And
Not only was it a Jew, but it was a rabbi. Not only was it a rabbi, it was a man. Not only was it a man, but it was a man asking her for water. A man who was a Jew and would never drink out of her cup because she was so filthy. But here was this guy, Jesus, living a life of surprise. Living a surprising life. I mean, the Bible says it right there. The woman was surprised, for Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. And she said to Jesus, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. Why are you asking me for a drink?" You live a surprising life. And she asked him the question. Jesus doesn't answer it. "You didn't ask me that." He says, "If only you knew the gift God has for you and who you're speaking to, you would ask me for a drink and I would give you living water." And that started this discussion that we all know about. Jesus lived a surprising life. Do things, go places where you're not supposed to be, and do things you're not supposed to do. That's what a surprising life looks like, as modeled by Jesus in John 4. And other places, he talked to Levi, the tax collector, in another place. And he walked on water in another place. He was always somewhere where he wasn't supposed to be, doing things that convention and the culture thought he wasn't supposed to do. My son plays in a band. We prayed for him, John told us, and we have prayed for him. In a couple weeks, he'll be playing in the worship band at his church, LCBC, York Campus in York, Pennsylvania. And he'll be playing lead guitar. If you go there and visit the last Sunday of January, he'll be the guy on the left-hand side of the stage as you look at it. When he was in junior high, we had a praise band in church, and he was a drummer then because he was pretty young, and the guitar players were a little older than him. There was a church down on the avenue, and in Lafayette, the avenue is a place nobody goes to. It's dangerous. There's about four prominent families that live in the avenue, and for the history of Lafayette, if you go down there, you're not one of those prominent families, you may not get out of the avenue alive. And I'm not exaggerating at all. And the avenue is cut off from the rest of the city by railroad tracks. So you can't even get there very easily. A church was begun by a pastor named Tom Camp down on the avenue. And this particular night, on Saturday nights, they turned their church building on the corner into a coffee shop. And our church band, which was my son and his buddies, came down. And Tom Camp's son had a band. He's about 5 or 6 years older. And their band played. And then our band played. And it was a coffee shop. And while that's happening, Tom Camp, who was saved as a heroin addict on the avenue, says to me, "Hey, let's go down the block on the corner." And he said, "We'll take a walk. I'm going to show you around the avenue." Well, the only way I could walk around at night on a Saturday night was with the guy who lived there. He takes me down, and where he takes me is we stand in the doorway of the only strip joint in town. Strip joints, for those of you listening on the radio, are places where people strip for money. And so I'm a pastor in one of the churches. His son's band's playing at the coffee house at their church, and my son's band's playing down there, and we're out walking the neighborhood. He says, "Listen, this business where there's sin going on round the clock, every day of the week, all week long, is sending people and my friends in my neighborhood to hell." I mean, all of a sudden, I'm walking with a guy who's living a surprising life, who's living a questionable life. Because now I'm surprised. I am someplace where I shouldn't be, doing something I shouldn't do. I'm standing in front of a strip joint as a pastor in the doorway. And when people drive by, what am I thinking? I'm thinking, you know what I'm thinking? There's only two things happening in the doorway of a strip joint when you're there. You're either going in or you're coming out. So I'm scared. I start praying, "Lord, help nobody in church to drive by." That was my prayer. Here's Tom Camp's prayer. He goes, "Will you pray with me right now that God will give me this building so we can send people to heaven out of this building where they've been getting sent to hell their whole life?" So we knelt down on the sidewalk and prayed. I'm still praying that nobody drives by and sees me. Because now I'm on the sidewalk. They'll think I'm drunk coming out. We prayed that God would give him that building. Within a year and a half to 2 years, God did not give him that building. He had to pay a dollar for it. So our sons, and God has worked in our sons' lives since then, are playing in their bands at the makeshift coffee house. We're praying for this strip joint. And tomorrow morning at 9:30, Lord willing, I get home safely, I'll meet there with the Lafayette area youth pastors in what is now the Sacred Grounds Coffee House. You want to live a questionable life?
Live a life of surprise. Jesus said, give me a drink. And the woman was surprised. You want to live a questionable life and reach this generation of kids? Live a changed life. Jesus starts that whole riff about living water, and you guys, we're all familiar with that. But in that whole thing, the girl says to me in front of the hot now Dunkin' Donuts in Brooklyn, New York, I didn't ask you that. That whole passage there, Jesus says, give me a drink. She says, what are you asking me for a drink for? She didn't answer him. He said, if you know what I was going to give you, you'd ask me for it. He didn't ask her. Every question that's asked and answered is different. 11, but sir, you don't have a rope or a bucket. Jesus says, I'll give you living water. The word for well, there's two words that you use in this passage. The first word is that hole in the ground. The second word, this one, is literally, you need a, it's the hole in the ground, down where the water is. And so you need a, something to get the water. You don't have a hole or a bucket. And the well's deep. Where would you get this living water? Besides, do you think you're, and so she gets sarcastic here with Jesus. Do you think you're better than Jacob? You're a Jew. Who, he gave us this well. How can you be better, and your water be better than his sons and his animals enjoys? See, the Samaritans took Jacob as one of their patriarchs as well as did the Jews. And she's saying, he's our father, and who do you think, basically she's saying, who do you think you are, buddy? Say you're going to give me living water out of this better than this beautiful well right here that our man Jacob gave us. Jesus replied, he didn't answer that question. He said, anyone who drinks my water, for the water in this well will soon become thirsty again. But those who drink the water I'll give will never be thirsty again. It becomes a fresh, bubbling spring within them, giving eternal life. She said, please, sir, give me some of this water. Then I'll never be thirsty again, and I won't have to come here to get water. Basically, she's saying, give me this water so I don't have to work like this anymore at noon so nobody sees me. Now somebody, I can really stay and hide, and I'll never have to come. And Jesus says, go get your husband. She says, I don't have one. Jesus said, you're right. You don't have a husband, for you have five husbands. And the man you're with now, you're not married to him. You certainly speak the truth. And she said, sir, you must be a prophet, so tell me. She changes the subject. Why is it that you Jews insist that Jerusalem is only a place of worship, while we Samaritans claim it's here at Mount Gerizim, where our ancestors worshipped? Jesus said, believe me, dear woman. Again, he doesn't answer a question. He said, the time's coming when that mountain worship won't make a difference and Jerusalem worship won't make a difference. He said, the time's coming. You're going to worship because of me in a different way. You're going to worship me. Because, verse 22, salvation comes through the Jews. But the time's coming, he says, and it's here now when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father's looking for those who will worship him. Salvation comes through the Jews. And the woman said, I know the Messiah is coming. The one who's called the Christ. And when he comes, he will explain everything to us. And Jesus says, I am the Messiah. Here's the thing about a questionable life. A questionable life is a surprising life. Another thing about a questionable life is that it's a changed life. And Jesus, in all of her questions, never answered her questions, but he kept aiming her toward a changed life. He kept steering her toward salvation. He kept steering her toward the Messiah, who actually was standing in front of her asking for water. He kept steering her toward her life being changed. She was a sarcastic, mean, Samaritan, sinning woman who had been married five times and was living with some guy that wasn't even her husband. And that none of that stuff bothered Jesus at all. The only thing he was concerned about, that those sins be forgiven. He wasn't concerned about keeping the law. He wasn't concerned about breaking the law. He was concerned about that she meet the Messiah. Because salvation comes from the Jews. And a questionable life is a changed life. And sometimes, guys, do we have such belief in the good news and what God's done in our heart and mind and our lives and our emotions, our spirit, our intellect, that we can't wait to tell people? Or do we say, man, I hope that guy doesn't ask me anything because I'm kind of timid and I got to go pick up my family. I got to get some tea. For
For God's a spirit. You worship him in spirit and truth. Truly the Messiah is coming. Jesus says, I'm the Messiah. And just then, the disciples showed up again. They were shocked to see him talking to the woman. They didn't say these questions. Again, you didn't ask me that. What do you want with her? Or why are you talking to her? While that's happening, the woman left her jar and went into town. And she said, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could he possibly be the Messiah? And so the people came streaming from the village to see him. Come see the man who told me everything I ever did, and could he pass? The people came streaming. So while the disciples are saying, Jesus, what are you doing this for? Buddy, what are you doing in front of that strip joint? Well, while they're thinking that, she's going in and saying, come and see this guy. He told me all about me. And they streamed out to see him. A questionable life is a surprising life. A questionable life is a changed life. Have we been saved from sin? How changed is your life? And it needs to be changed completely, because scriptures say we're new creations. We're babies. We're just like we were born again. Oh, he just said that to Nicodemus in the chapter previously in the book of John. By the way, the book of John, and we know this stuff too, is intended only so that we would know and believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And so that was his mission. He's living a questionable life by going through Samaria and asking this lady for water and surprising her. It looks like a life of surprise. It looks like a life that's been changed. It also looks like a life that is awake and alert. And I love this next thing, because the disciples come back. The word verse 31. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging Jesus, Rabbi, meanwhile, while the lady's gone and told her buddies, her friends, about what this man said to her, meanwhile, the disciples say, Rabbi, eat something. And Jesus says, I have a kind of food you don't know about. There we go again. He's talking about stuff they didn't ask him about. Did someone bring him food while we were gone? The disciples said. Then Jesus said this, and this is some cool verses. My nourishment comes from doing the will of God who sent me and from finishing his work. You know the saying, 4 months between planting and harvest. But I say, wake up and look around. A changed life is a wide awake life. It's an awake and alive life. A questionable life is an awake and an alive life. Wake up and look around, Jesus says. The fields are already ripe. The harvesters are paid good wages, and the fruit they harvest is people. The fruit is people brought to eternal life. Wake up and look around. And basically he's saying, forget about that 4 month stuff. It's already here. The fruit is people brought to eternal life. And he says, what joy awaits the planter, the harvester alike? One plants another harvest, and it's true. I sent you to the harvest where you did not plant. Others did the work, and now you will get to gather the harvest. Others did the work, and now you will get to gather the harvest. Wake up and look around. I love that line. And then he says, forget that 4 months. The harvest is people, and they're ready to harvest. You're going to harvest a crop that you never planted. There is a group of kids coming down the pike right now. At our churches, at our towns, at our ministries. It's a harvest that we did not plant, but it's ready to and ripe to be harvested. And that harvest is people. There's a guy named Ron Clark. He lived in Atlanta, Georgia. And I don't know if you've ever heard of him. And I just was introduced to him last week via the news. And if this works, this guy wrote a book about education, and he has a school then in Atlanta for 5th through 8th graders, and they're learning stuff. And so people are starting to catch on to that. Why are kids that age learning stuff? And so am I okay on time, John? If you don't know, I'm good. This is a video that was on the news last week. Listen to his words. Watch his face. Watch his body movements. This is a guy that something has changed his life or somebody. It actually was his influence and his grandmother. Changed his life. So a questionable life surprises people. A questionable life is a strange life. And a questionable life is wide awake for specific reasons. Listen to what this guy says.
And here they are. There goes Brian. And we'll welcome back in our kids and our dancing teacher. It is the founder of Ron Clark Academy, Mr. Ron Clark himself, the principal and founder, and a couple of his students, Mason Calhoun and Jaden Lindsay. Are you guys out of breath after that performance? It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Ron, for people who missed our interview during our regular show, this is our internet show that will live on forever on foxandfriends.com. Tell us about Ron Clark Academy and how it's so unique.
Our school is the most amazing place in the world. It's a middle school, but we teach with passion and innovation. But the key is that we make it hard. I promise you, we are probably the hardest middle school in the world, but we infuse fun, passion. We wrap our lessons. We transform our classrooms. We stand on our heads if we have to. We find a way to get our kids to love to learn. And because of that, they're willing to do the hard work. But the best part is that we invite educators from all over the country and around the world to come to our school. Each week, hundreds come. They sit in our classes. They learn about our methods. They watch Hope King Tees. They're in Dr. Jones's classroom. They learn from the phenomenal Susan Barnes. And they take those ideas and they implement them all over the world. So it's pretty incredible.
Well, if it's so hard, why are all those kids smiling? I'm wondering to myself. And Ron, as these people, these educators come from all over the world to look at what you're doing, what are you doing differently down in Georgia than they're doing, for instance, in the public schools here in New York City?
I'll say, for number one, for example, in my fifth grade class, I have 37 kids. 37 kids in fifth grade class with us. And what we do is we look at our class, we find the smartest student, and that's who we teach to. We focus on the top, and then we use the passion to get all the kids up to that level. Usually in public school, we dumb it down. We don't make it hard enough. And if you make it hard, but it's not fun, the kids will be like, oh man, it's so hard. What we do is we make it hard, and we push the kids, but we dress in costumes. We reenact historical events. We do things to make it exciting so the kids are willing to get to that level. One thing that we do here, our teachers, for example, Wade King, he won't sit down all day long. Brandon Fleming's on his feet teaching with passion. We don't have desks for teachers because we don't have time to sit down. We got one chance to make a difference in the lives of these kids, and when you put your whole heart and effort into it, you can be successful.
So are you a charter school? Is that what you do there?
We're a private school,
oh, private
but
school.
We made it so that it's affordable.
Oh, yes. Interesting. Because about, you know, so often charter schools are the ones that are known for doing all those innovative things, and you're doing that in a more traditional private school setting. Congratulations to you. Where did you come up with this idea to just infuse all this energy into the classroom with students?
The idea for this song was just something that was silly. It was over winter break. We had taken the kids to see Star Wars. We'd gone to the out to eat. And we wanted to do something fun. And I just texted some kids and said, y'all want to come do this challenge and film a song? We added it online thinking it was just something silly to do, but then it just kind of blew up. And it was incredible. And what's interesting about our school is that we have all different types of kids here, all different types of learning levels, all different types of income levels of families. And so what it shows that, regardless of the individual child, every child can be successful when you teach in this way.
Well, you're learning us this morning because we know the whip and the nay-nay. We've had a few guests on the program showing us how to do that. What is the Millie Rock? You do the Millie Rock? What is that?
Okay.
Are we going to start seeing that on the sidelines of the NFL and weddings and stuff too?
So it's kind of you have to do a swirling motion and then swipe. It's like a flight.
Cutting the fruit. Okay, let's see how we do.
Well, which way are you cutting it?
Let's cut it towards the fruit. And then cut the fruit.
We should not.
Okay.
Do this.
No? Yeah, I think you guys should probably take this away. Ron, let's let her rip. Let's see you guys do it again.
You want to dance one more time? All right,
yeah.
We got it. All right, let's go. Kids, you ready? All right, here we go.
What do you notice about that guy?
Real quick.
He loves what he's doing.
He loves what he's doing. What else? He's excited. What else?
Energy.
What else?
He loves fashion.
He loves them. If you look on the website, one of the main, he's got like 54 or 12 philosophies. One of them is, we are our family. He loves them. What else?
He had his elbow on the kitchen.
We're a family.
The whole time.
he touches their heads. Google that guy or whatever. You know, Chris will let you look on YouTube or whatever. And look at some of those videos and stuff. And he's always touching the kids. He's grabbing their heads and shoulders and patting them. But it comes from the family aspect. What else?
Commitment.
Commitment. To what? All right, to the purpose. What else?
A game plan.
Game plan?
Who's with them?
Who's with them? Did you see the blonde-haired lady smiling over his shoulder? She's like co-owner of that thing. He mentioned her name and running. You know, the guy is famous worldwide for teaching, and he told about all his teachers. You know, all he told about himself was he had an idea and said, "Let's dance," and so they did. Dancing is a reward for success there. So you get to join the dance club. Here's something that he said in another video he said. He said, "We have one chance to make a difference in the life of kids." Did you hear him say that? We have one chance to make a difference in the life of kids. In another video I watched, it's around right after this, he says, "If we don't reach kids where they are, we're going to lose them." We have one chance to make a difference in life, kids. If we don't reach kids where they are, we're going to lose them. That's a guy, I think, living a questionable life. He bought a warehouse in Old Factory in downtown Atlanta because he believes that we have one chance to reach kids. If we don't, we'll lose it. A questionable life is a surprising life. It's a changed life. A questionable life is a wide awake life. And Jesus tells his boys, he says, "Wake up and look around." And I would suggest to us, wake up and look around. Because there's already a harvest. Jesus promises, and you will reap it. I love that. He says, and you will gather the harvest. Not, hey, try. Hey, get good tools. Hey, do this. You will gather the harvest. And I submit to you that when you live a questionable life, and a life that's surprising, and a life that's changed, and a life that's wide and awake and alert, you're going to change some kids. And then the last thing, while all this has happened, the lady's going telling them, "Hey, come see this guy who told me everything about me," and they start walking. And I think why Jesus pointed to that wheat in the fields, the townspeople are walking through the fields right at him. That's the picture that I've seen in my mind. Verse 39, "And many Samaritans from the village believed in Jesus because a woman had said, 'He told me everything I ever did.' And when they came out to see him, they begged him to stay in their village, and so he stayed there for 2 days." A questionable life, the last thing. The questionable life tells the story. "He told me everything I ever did," the lady said, "and so they all came out to meet Jesus." A questionable life is a surprising life. A questionable life is a changed life. A questionable life is a wide awake life. And a questionable life tells a story. This generation, and people that are advertising to this generation that's coming and that is really here right now, says you better be able to tell a story in about 30, 35 seconds or you're going to lose them. Lose their interest. The lady knew how to do that. "Come and see this guy that told me everything I ever did. He could be the Messiah." A couple chapters later, this guy is blind and all of a sudden he can see. "I don't know what his name is. I do know I once was blind, but now I see." Can we tell our story like that? We need to have a story. I was in the locker room a couple weeks ago. Two guys, a heavyweight who's African-American kid and a 220-pounder who's a mixed-race Latin and white kid. And they're all bigger than me. You know, pretty much the 103-pounders were like bigger than me. And, you know, they're all doing this. Wanting me to flinch, those two guys. They're younger. I never flinch. I laugh every time they do it because to me it's like comical. I say, I always tell them, "Is that the best you got, man? I'm an old white guy. You can do better than that." So a couple of weeks ago they asked me, they said, how come you're not afraid of us, coach? Every old white guy we know is afraid of us. To them, it's a joke. I said, "Because I'm not." I said, "I do New Hope for Philadelphia, Chicago, New York City every year, and I see really rough kids, and you're not them." He said, "What would you do if I really hit you, if I followed through?" I said, "Well, I'd pick myself off the floor, and then I'd use tools." He said, "What's that mean?" There was a lock, you know, locks spin around, master lock, and it's like 0 through 40. I said, I'd pick this up, and I'd say, hey, look at your buddy, and when you did, I'd put this lock upside your head so hard, you'd have 0 through 40 in your cheek for a week. He said, how could you do that? Questions. They didn't ask. And my story was, I'm the most evil person in every room I'm in. And I said, so you too, you don't even approach how mean I am. That's how I could do that. And they said, well, we've never seen that in you. And I said, the Bible said the heart's deceitful and desperately wicked. Nobody can know how bad that is. But I know. But if it wasn't for God working in my life through his son Jesus and forgiving my sins, I'd be in jail or dead right now. So my story was, if it wasn't for God working in my life right now, I'd either be in jail or dead. Which started a process of questions. Just like John chapter 4. When were you ever in trouble? I said, well, the first time I sat in the back of a police car was somewhere between third and fourth grade. I didn't think my next door neighbor needed her windows that day. She kept calling the police on me for playing the street. So I broke her windows. She goes, really? I said, yeah, but remember, if it wasn't God working in my life through his son Jesus, I'd be in jail or dead. Starting when I was in third grade. What's your story? Questionable Eyes tells a story. Come see this guy that told me everything about me. My dad was blind. Come see him. I once was blind, but now I see. If it wasn't for God working in my life through Jesus, I'd be in jail or dead. I learned a witnessing tool a few years ago at a conference that we were at Indiana Wesleyan with the Grace Brethren, and they said fish was their acrostic. Fish, be friendly. The I stood for initiate a conversation. The S stood for a story. Share your story. And the H stood for leave your person in your conversation with hope. So we did that all weekend. And one night, on the very last night, I was in the bathroom there. I'm old. I have to go a lot. So I'm in there doing my thing. Just standing there at the urinal. And a four-year-old boy who was the son of the director of Urban Hope in Philadelphia. I'm alone in the... He comes walking in. Hi! He had a captive audience, man. I said, hi, how you doing, bud? Oh, not very good. Why not? Well, I have to change my pants. You know, and I'm thinking 3-year-old, 4-year-old boy. Had an accident. I said, you have an accident? Oh, first I said, what's your name? He said, my name's Johnny. I said, Johnny, did you have an accident? No, I didn't have an accident. I have my pants on backwards. Sometimes Christians put their pants on backwards. Are you a Christian? That kid got it. That's a questionable life. He really went somewhere he wasn't supposed to be in the bathroom all by himself when he's 3 years old. And he surprised me. He had a changed life. He was a Christian. He was wide awake and alert. And he told me a story. Sometimes Christians put their pants on backwards. Are you a Christian? I said, yes, I am, John. Thanks. Would you live a questionable life and reach this generation that's walking towards you through the fields ready for harvest? I pray that you do that. That we become like Jesus. Become a non-anxious presence in places we shouldn't be, talking to people we shouldn't talk to, surprising everybody. With our changed lives, and we're wide awake for the opportunities to tell our story. Can I get a witness? Melvin?
First of all, no one else here in the room has the right to call me Melvin.
Again, thanks. God uses resurrection. And
Yeah, let's pray. Please check out of the hotel. Go talk to them or whatever. But be safe today and keep in touch. And yeah, stand with me.